This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz. This program is sponsored by New Zealand Bridge, sponsors of Grassroots Bridge across the nation.
Welcome to the Bridge Zone. You're at the table with Mariana, and this week we have Kermit. So Pam Livingston is in the house. It was a great weekend.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. I thank you for having us to stay, Russell Wilson and I, and our lovely director, Kevin Poo. He's a very good director, I think. And yeah, just had a really nice time catching up with you, Mariana. Yeah. Thank you very much.
That's all right. So we're talking about the Hamilton Congress. Well, you can tell me about the teams. Congratulations for the Shirley Weymouth Open Pairs. Those winners were Ian Barrington and Graham Tufnell. And the restricted pairs were won by Marcus Dudley and Gordon Zong. A couple of youth players coming through in the restricted pairs. The teams events, who took that out?
First in the open teams were Ian Barrington and Graham Tufnell. They took out the double, and their teammate Brian Mace and Malcolm Mayer. My team was second. I was pleased with that. I was playing with Russell Wilson, and we were playing with Gary Chen and John Wang, and we had a great time. Gee, there were some great cards. In one set in the final, so six teams went through to the final, we were playing against Jack James and Wayne Burrows. 10 boards, one grand slam, this is our way, two slams, and we actually missed one slam. It was a bit tricky to bid. 10 boards.
Wow.
Whoa. Yeah. That was great.
There were some outrageous hands, weren't there?
So that always makes it fun, and there's always lots of imps riding on those hands. I mean, you can go along and be in one no trump or two spades or something. You know, when the opponents bid to six hearts and you've got the option of taking the six spade die, but hang on a minute, you've made them guess about whether to bid six hearts, so you might just be giving them a free ticket. This is a really good example. It's really actually hard to know what to do.
So tell me about it.
This was a great hand. So we are vulnerable and the opponents are not. Well, my right-hand opponent opened one spade, and I held singleton jack, ace king jack to seven hearts, four to the ten of diamonds, and singleton six of clubs. That's quite a nice hand. So yep. I kind of thought, am I going to just bid four hearts here or three hearts? Or I don't know, have you heard that old saying that when you bid four hearts, it's a transfer for the opponents to bid four spades?
Yes, I have heard that.
You heard that one, right?
Yep.
This is what I love about bridge. You've got to make these decisions reasonably quickly. So I thought I might just walk the dog a little bit, and I bid two hearts, and I got three spades on my left. Mm-hmm. So now my partner bids four spades,
right,
which is key card for hearts. So he's obviously got a pretty serious hand. And then the one spade opener bid five spades, so not giving me any room for us to investigate. I just love these auctions. I love them so much because it's like, who knows?
However, so what'd you do? Bid six hearts.
I did, because, you know, partners just leapt into key card, and I know they don't have fabulous hearts. I've got them. So anyway, I just bid six hearts. And the opponents now have a tough decision. Do they bid six spades as a dive? Or have they done their work and made us guess? And in this case, they didn't dive. A dive is quite profitable in this hand. But, you know, I always think that you make the opponents guess. You roll the dice, make them guess. And once they've guessed, you've just got to accept that sometimes they've guessed right. Rolling the dice, making them guess, and then going in again is just giving them a double shot. It's quite hard to sit back and think, oh, I really think I should be pushing them more. I don't want to just bid six hearts. What are you going to do? I had to guess. We could easily be missing
Two,
ace, king of diamonds or something. That was a cool hand and that's it.
For the record, from the six teams, three of them were in six hearts, two were in six spades double, going four off, and one was in five spades double, going three off. It is
So
an extreme.
1430 for the slam
Yep.
and 800 for six spades doubled. It was right to dive in this case, but who knows? Who knows? I
Yeah, there were some exceptional hands.
love those heads.
They're great, aren't they? Now, over the weekend, we were talking about a funny convention that I'd never ever heard of. And is it kokish?
Yeah, a kokish relay. And I had heard of it, but I only sort of played it
Yeah.
this year for the
So, how
first
does it
time, and
work?
I quite like it. So, opening two clubs strong is generally, there's a bit of variation on this, but
Yep.
23 plus balanced, and get those odd hands that are really strong, like 25 plus balanced. So, a kokish relay allows you to tell partner you're more than 23, 24 balance. So
Okay.
how it works is you open your two clubs, partner bids two diamonds, and you bid two hearts. Now, two hearts is either I've got hearts or I've got extra values balance, so I'm 25 plus balance.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So then responder bids two spades and says, which one is it? And if opener bids two no trumps, then it's the 25 plus balanced hand. And if they make any other bid, they've got heart. So they might bid three hearts because they're single suited,
Right.
or they might bid three clubs to say, I've got hearts and clubs. It gives a little bit more room in the auction. So that allows you to show that really big balanced hand that you get, once a year or twice a year.
Every now and again,
So that's a kokish relay.
yeah. Yeah, I could see how that would make describing your big hand really well. So if you're unbalanced, you just bid a suit
Yeah.
with a jump if you've got
Yes.
25 plus.
If you've got a suit, you make your normal bid. If your suit happens to be heart, then you clarify after
Oh.
partner bids two spades. So you just make your normal suit bid, but if it's hearts, it might be extra strong balance. So
Ah. Okay.
it's not too tricky, I don't think.
There was a hand. It was really strange because I reckon it depends on what type of partner you have.
Okay, what type of partner? What are your categories, Marietta? What's your types?
Whether you've got an aggressive partner
Right.
or whether you've got a conservative partner. So
Okay, so those are the two bidding style partners, aggressive and conservative.
We're all vulnerable, and it goes one heart by partner, one spade, then
Yep.
I bid two diamonds. So I've got an
I'm with
11
you
count,
so
and I'm
far. I'm agreeing with all of this. Yep.
so I've got an 11 count with 5-5 in the minors, and then pass by north, and partner bids four no trumps, and then it's pass. Last bid suit is diamonds. I show them that I have two key cards, ace clubs, and the king of diamonds.
Yes.
And partner then bids. Now, this is where you've got to come in and try and figure out what type of partner you have. Okay, so you've denied a fit in heart, but partner's got lovely heart, and I guess they're trying to get the best score possible, and hearts are better than the minors, so they bid. Knowing that they have a fit in diamonds, they bid six hearts.
Right.
And you put down dummy, and then, of course, you get a lead of the ace of spades, and then they signal to say that they are short in diamonds and comes a diamond, and there's a rough one-off. Partner could have bid six diamonds and accepting that you have a great fit because partner's actually got five diamonds. You have a great
Well,
diamond fit. So I reckon if you decide to go for the highest score in the majors, that that's quite an aggressive one because partner hasn't agreed hearts. If you just are comfortable and conservative, you take the six diamond slam. So what do you reckon?
Well, I think that I'm looking at this hand and it says it's in a Swiss pears field.
Yep.
So, bidding a slam in a Swiss pears field or even a team's field, you want to bid the safest one you can. The difference between whether you are in a making six hearts or in a making six diamonds is just negligible. But the difference between making six diamonds and going off in six hearts is huge. So you
Yes.
just want to bid the safest slam that you can find, and you know that you've got at least a nine card diamond fit. I'd be going for diamonds every time.
Right.
You'd want to get positive scores.
The funny thing is, some people obviously went down in six hearts because they got a diamond rough, and some people made six hearts because I reckon they didn't believe Hart had a diamond void. There was only three tables that bid six diamonds. The rest of them, there's five diamonds. There's smatterings around. Two people bid six hearts and went one off.
Okay, let's have a look at this because this is just great. So the score for going off in six hearts is minus 12.78 imps, right? The score for making six hearts was 10.11, and the score for making six diamonds was nine. We're looking at a 1 imp difference between six diamonds and six hearts
And six
making,
hearts.
and we've got a 22 imp swing for going down in six hearts. I think those numbers, they stack up. Let's bid the safest slam we can at puss pairs and imps, at imp scoring.
That's a great tip. Really great tip. Partner bid what's in their hand and they make that decision. One thing that was funny was partner says, I think you might kill me after this. And I was like, no, you do what you do, you know?
This is something we love about Bridge, isn't it? There's always a new mistake to make, and there's always a new lesson to learn.
That's exactly right. We join Peter Hollins for some more of his clip talking about rising Bridge legends.
He is young, he is brilliant, he is French. And he used to be good looking. I am talking about Thomas Bessie. Right after my incident at the table against Ron and Lotan, many people, bridge players, came to me after they'd heard I'd called the director against Lotan. About 10 bridge stars immediately came to me and told me such things as, "Whatever happened, I am with you." Or, "Whatever happened, I think the same as you." Or, again, "If you need someone to punch him once and for all, I'm your man." I have no idea who would have said that, but that is just like. So, Lotan and Ron ended up winning, but by an they got an incredibly high score. And then after this, the organizing team of the tournament has already decided to forbid them from play next year, as many top players complained about their presence there. This is quite a difficult position to take for the organizers, as there is officially nothing else than rumors. So it'd be quite big if a thing like that happens. Nothing is official yet, but investigations have started. So you might think, if all this is true, if it is so clear to everybody, why haven't they been caught yet? Discipline instances and ruling in our game are not made to catch cheaters quickly. The procedure is long, and in order to start an official investigation, you need to have real facts that bridge directors don't have. Bridge players lack intelligence in this field. Instead of calling the director anytime something seems suspect to them, they prefer to talk about the board with their friends and spread rumors, which have no legitimacy at all for directors, and which don't help catching the cheaters. This also explains why there are some other international pairs in the bridge world also suspected who are still playing at a high level. I actually cannot believe what I'm writing. Those two guys are still juniors, so very wrong, and they should be the light of our sport. People should be happy for them, happy to see that a new young generation is already at the top of the game and ready to fight against older ones. Yes, it should be like that, but the fact is, nobody is happy. They are so young and already so much suspected. How is this possible? People usually like to be blind about this kind of problem and prefer to think that the other players are straight. It's so much easier and so much better to think this way. I'll finish this on a well-thought comparison. As with Lance Armstrong in cycling, everybody knew he had taken some illegal medicine. Winning 7 Tour de France in a row, coming back from a recovered cancer, was just impossible without cheating. But it was so much more convenient to think he was straight and to consider him as a god. It is very natural to prefer dreaming to see the world in pink. But believe me, the Fischer-Schwarz case is not pink at all. Just on a note about that, he talks about calling the director to report sort of unusual things. One thing that I want to emphasize here, that when you're playing bridge, if you see your opponents do something strange, yeah, you can call the director and just say, hey, I just want this recorded. You don't want to just put out a cheating accusation. It's very harsh to accuse someone of cheating just on one hand. Strange things can happen. But what you want to do is build like this body of evidence that these strange things keep happening and they keep succeeding as well. So don't just accuse people of cheating, but you can make directors take note and say, hey, this is what actually happened. So I just wanted to clarify that. But back to Thomas, he's also not only an excellent player, not only was he recording and taking notes and investigating into the cheating saga that happened, he's also a coach. He started doing coaching of the USA 2 team. So in 2023, Thomas took on a new challenge, coaching the Team USA 2 at the World Championship in Marrakesh, Morocco, coaching legends like Zia Mahmoud, who he had previously gotten to play with because of that hand he'd won as a junior. Thomas even shared a humorous glimpse into the life of a bridge coach, broke down his day and explained what he did. 7:33 a.m., my wife wakes up to go jogging in 153 degrees. I'm not coming today, sweetheart. Maybe tomorrow. 8:47, time to wake up and shower. 9:12, breakfast with the opponent's convention cards for the day. I highlight a couple of things in green. After all, I have to pretend to work a bit. 9:53, I look for my badge with the American flag. Still weird. 9:49, I get to the playing area. Always the same question. Where the hell is Zia's cushion? 9:55, we find Zia's cushion. Some woman had slept with it. 9:56, Zia wants to change half of the system and start sharing his ideas with Mech. Mech seems absolutely delighted. 10:17, back to the room. Clicking refresh, nothing. Refresh, nothing. Refresh, we won 13. 11:54, back to the playing area. 4 boards left in the closed room, 2 in the open room. I decide to wait in front of the open room. 12:03, 1-2 on board 15. Still, nobody's out. 12:06, I enter the open room and find out Brad and Joe are not there. How the hell did this happen? 12:07, I go in front of the closed room and wait there. 12:11, I check in the closed room. Mech and Zia are already gone. 12:16, I finally find everyone. We won comfortably, so nobody actually notices I wasn't there. Lunch with Zia by the pool. He gets some olives, signs a few autographs, sells a couple of books. The routine of a superstar. 1:06 p.m. Getting ready for the second match. Chip smiles, Marty walks, Brad laughs, all good. 1:12, need to make copies of our convention's convention card for the next days. Jan Martell tells me it's probably not that useful as we already have 17 different summaries of each pair's system, but I don't care. I brought my green highlighting pen for a goddamn reason, and I intend to use it. 3:18, time to compare. Win 8, win 12, win 13, lose 4. Chip's mustache goes nuts. 3:21, Marty noticed this mustache madness and wants to go for a walk. 3:25, we've said bad things about 27 different bridge players. 3:27, Marty and I are lost. 3:38, here we go again. Have to take care of Mr. Mahmood's sensitive bottom. 4:21, feel I deserve to swim in the pool. 5:59. Win 12. Lose 5. Win 19. Mech tells me I've been fantastic today. 6:03. Marty wants to go for a walk. Zia wants to go for a glass of wine. I find some lame excuse for Marty and join Zia. 7:22. Here comes my most important task of the day. Pick the wine. I'm in an adventurous mood and go Moroccan. Zia approves. Phew. 8:52, back to the hotel. 9:43, paddle with Brink, driver and Joe. Joe breaks a couple of rackets, but at least it's not on Brad's head. 11:42, back to the room, quick shower, Netflix on. Irene falls asleep after 3 minutes, me after seven. What I loved there was Tomas showed that while the pressure of the competition is high, he never loses his sense of humour.
And we'll hear more from Peter Hollins on A Legend's Rise next week.
Coming up next, we're heading off to the courthouse. Director, please.
How can I help?
Judge Julie presiding.
Right, now this is a question for week three, and both of you can probably answer this for me.
I doubt it.
So when you have a tournament and you need to gather in an appeals committee,
yeah,
how do you go about picking who's on it?
Okay, there are several things about appeals committees. One of them is what sort of ruling it is, because some of the time when rulings are around the laws, you might choose to have people on the appeals committee who have a good knowledge of the law. So this is where someone's arguing about maybe a time penalty or a revoke where they're not happy with the result, but the director has ruled. Now, a director that makes a ruling that is based on the law can't normally be appealed. If they are, well, they can be, but if they are, generally you're going to be hit up for a frivolous appeal where you get charged extra money or extra percentage points for not doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. But there are some things around the law that get interesting that are sort of just a bit weird. Okay.
So are you saying that potentially they should all be a director in their own right?
Oh, no. The whole point of appeals is that when we direct, we're not necessarily great players. I learned to direct. I've been playing 6 months when I was directing.
Yeah.
So when you start directing, a lot of people that direct aren't necessarily representing New Zealand or even province or anything like that. They are just people that enjoy the contact with people and they enjoy doing what they do, which is great. But you don't have to be able to play well. An appeal committee is a trial by jury. It is made up of people who are meant to be your, generally are going to be people that can make good decisions about the play or the option, that understand bridge more than perhaps the director does. The director is about the laws.
Okay.
And not about playing ability. And I'd really, really like to get it out there. If you want to direct, you do not have to be a good player. The best directors are people that are good with people, that help people enjoy the game and can make rulings that keep the play going. When I first directed at Congress, I had a really difficult ruling that the current New Zealand team, I think, were involved with something that happened after a hesitation, and I had to make this ruling. And I was nowhere near as good as these people. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the right answer was, so that if they appealed it, I wasn't going to be stupid. But I didn't really need to do that. I could have asked somebody about what the right thing was.
Barry, so how do you go about picking a or suggesting an appeals committee?
I always go for the best looking ones.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Can I point out that normally the match committee are the people that choose the appeal committees. But you have to be careful because you don't want to choose people that aren't involved in the appeal or not involved with the people that are in the appeal.
I have to say that our match committee usually lets the director pick their own appeal committee. Yeah. But, you know.
Pretty normal. Yeah, apart from anything else, when you're directing, a lot of the people that are going to appeal are the people that you want on the appeal committee. So whoever it is, you've got to work around them as well.
I mean, the match committee in the main, or most match committees probably don't know the players as well as the director does, I think.
When I first moved to Auckland, I directed an 8B in one of the clubs, and I had two appeal committees sitting because no one knew me. So they wanted to argue with me.
Who's this little lady that's telling us what to do?
Well, no, I was also quite young as well, so that probably didn't help. I had a lot of things against me. I didn't come from Auckland. Might have been one of the first ones.
Yeah, you weren't a Jaffa. Okay.
I'm not.
just to be clear about it. So I had two appeal committees the first time I directed in Auckland because the players didn't trust me, I presume, to know the laws.
All right. Thank you, Judgy. Right. We're back with Kermit again. What's your next tournament?
Well, I wasn't planning to play much bridge for the rest of the year. As you know, at the end of May, I had a bit of an accident. And after all these years of riding, I finally had a bad accident riding. So I haven't been playing much because I haven't been able to sit all day. But I actually managed fine over the 2 days. So that was great. So I'm actually playing next weekend. I'm really pleased to see that the Zelda Morris Piers, that's usually in Hawke's Bay, which is a 5-hour drive for me, that's gone online. So I'm playing next weekend. And then I'm going up to Auckland the weekend after to play the National Piers. Ooh. This is me not playing much bridge.
Listeners, join in if you want to play in an online tournament. I believe it's 2 Saturday afternoon sessions and 1 Sunday session. And it is online, so they should get fabulous numbers.
Yeah, no, I was really pleased to hear that. I've always enjoyed that tournament when I go to it, where you have 2 afternoons and then, you know, the morning. And I think that's quite a nice way for the weekend too. You can get stuff done on Saturday morning, whatever your stuff is. Yep. And then you can do stuff on Sunday afternoon. So, yeah, I think it's a good one.
Hey, let's end on a positive. Talking about Barry. Fantastic.
Oh, I'm so thrilled for them. And they'll be having a lovely time. And I think that team, quite apart from being good bridge players, they're good friends. And it would be a very harmonious experience. And I think that's a thing that's a little bit underrated in these things. And I'm just so pleased they're having a great time. It's been a great experience for them.
If you haven't already, but have a listen. It's an uncut version of the Zoom chat that we had with Barry. So if it's a bit messy, I apologise. I certainly didn't have time to edit that because we were racing off the bridge. I was really grateful that he actually fitted us into their schedule. We stopped them celebrating with wine and orange juice. It's awesome. And congratulations to the women as well who qualified. Sadly for the seniors and open, but they've got other stuff that they can go in and do some damage to the other countries after the playoffs.
Yeah, well, you're at one of those things. It was great that Barry took the time because, honestly, you go to those events and that's your whole world for that period is you're just living and breathing this event and you sort of forget that the rest of the world's out there. So good on them.
Well, we might see you online this weekend and face-to-face at the fairs that is being held in Auckland.
Oh, it's lovely to see you, Mariana.
Kermit's going to be with us for the next couple of weeks as Barry does his thing over in Argentina. Take care, everybody.
See ya.
New Zealand Bridge, sponsoring bridge from beginner to international nationwide. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.